Hey there. If you are looking for ways to support the network that don't involve spending extra money, consider going to duckfeed.tv/tipjar and using the Amazon links there. If you're going to be buying any of these Stephen King books that we're talking about, or audiobooks, any of those things, use that link. It takes you to the Amazon that you know, and we get a small cut of the proceeds of whatever you buy. Once again, that is duckfeed.tv/tipjar. If you want to follow along with The Mist or any of these others. Additionally, for this episode, I want to issue a general content warning for things related to suicide, because that is tied up in the book itself. No spoilers. It's about a disaster, et cetera, et cetera. So if that's going to make your day worse by hearing that, consider if this is the episode for you. Otherwise... Welcome to Radio Free Midworld, a podcast about the Dark Tower series of books and its related works by Stephen King. I am your host, Cole Ross, and today I am joined by...
Gary Butterfield.
Yeah, welcome. Hello. Gary. Yeah. And
hi.
Today we are beginning the off-season between The Wastelands and Wizard and Glass by talking about some Dark Tower-related works. Now, this is going to be a very long off-season to mimic the long break between those two books. Really, I just wanted to give us time to read The Stand, but let's hold up that artifice. Gary, welcome.
Hi.
Hey.
I did not read The Stand. So I'm yeah. Just coming through with just I chose the shortest of the works. I went novella.
Yes,
novella for me.
A lot of people listening probably know who you are, but just in case there is one of those hypothetical people who does not listen to the other shows that we do, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I am on with you on most of the shows on Duckfeed. So we do Watch Out for Fireballs and Abject Suffering and File Underwater and Monster My Podcast together, and formerly Bonfireside Chat. And then I also do Days of Future Cast with Jeremy Greer and Teenage Dirtbags with Brayton Cameron.
Both of whom have been on the show.
Yeah. Which is, former alum, Radio Free Midworld alum. I was not been on this show, but I saw on the calendar that we planned things that you were covering The Mist. And I've always wanted an excuse to read it because it is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
So
I watched the movie as well. And we're primarily going to be talking about the book, but it's going to be hard not to talk about cool things that the movie does, because it is very, very good.
It's so accurate. Like, just in the world of adaptation, not even in the world of Stephen King adaptation, like it is an extremely accurate adaptation.
Yeah.
To the book.
Yeah. That's Darabont's thing. This concluded like the trilogy. Like, he did The Shawshank Redemption. He did The Green Mile, and then he did this before going into Walking Dead land.
Which is not an accurate adaptation.
No,
like, that's also a work of adaptation, and it's especially the first seasons, the stuff that Darabont worked on, goes wildly left field.
Yeah.
In that show. So it's very strange to see him have this entirely different value with these books.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about Stephen King in the past. Have you had any experience with him outside of when I made you read that Dark Tower comic for Try This?
I have read probably 6 or 7 short stories.
Okay.
Some of which I remember the name of, some of which I don't. No novels. I bought The Dark Tower, but have not started reading it yet.
The Gunslinger.
Or The Gunslinger.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, it was a test. passed, Ross.
I mean, there is a book called The Dark Tower, but it would be very strange to start with that one.
I'm just going to work my way from the middle out. It's a middle out reading system.
Yeah.
So I've only really read short stories, and like in general, have stayed away in part just because of length. Like, a lot of times they are very long, wordy books.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, I just don't read tons of fiction anymore. Like, it didn't get me in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, a lot of people I know who really love Stephen King got into him when they were younger.
Yeah.
And grew, you know, that affection. I'm not saying that as a slight, like, that affection grew and became deeper and more nuanced as they got older.
Yeah.
And stuck with them. It's not, I'm not saying it's like books for kids.
No,
I just think
no.
People's like real hard, like going real hard into a fantasy or sci-fi or horror author. Mm-hmm. As far as fiction, tends to happen to people when they're young.
Yes.
I read other stuff during the period where that would have definitely got me.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's great to have you on here because I really like the story an awful lot. I like the movie that sprung off of it. I intended to watch the new television adaptation, but some things intervened that I was not able to. That seems very misguided to me because what's amazing about this story is how compact it is.
It's like a bottle episode.
Yeah.
And the show is not supposed to be very good.
Right.
You know, I kind of keep up in general with AV Club reviews of TV shows. And because I like the movie so much, I read that and some other reviews of the TV, you know, the TV show. Cause you know, I was like, oh, like that's weird. They're making that. How do they do that? Mm-hmm. And it turns out not very well is what it sounds like. I also don't have any experience with it though.
Yeah. So The Mist is a novella by Stephen King. And it was originally published as a part of a short story collection called Dark Forces, which is also a Star Wars game. But this is back in 1980, which makes this a very early Stephen King work. It's not like Carrie early, but like for reference, The Stand came out in 1979, I believe, 1979 or 1980, somewhere around there. So like this is him swinging young, you know, and then most people probably know this from when it either came out in Skeleton Crew, which is another short story collection of just
a really bad Genesis game that Stephen King is really weirdly attached to.
Yep.
It's like Michael Jackson on Sonic, Stephen King on Skeleton Crew.
It's always Genesis. Yeah. Oh, also the Genesis game. And then this was released as its own standalone thing alongside when the movie came out. The basic premise of this is that there's a town in Maine, obvs, called Bridgeton, an actual town, that is kind of overrun by this otherworldly mist that has brought these horrible creatures along with it. And a bottle episode is actually very apt because most of it takes place inside of a supermarket with this, you know, pretty sizable group of people and, you know, kind of looks at the way that they cope with this disaster. Right.
Yeah. That's what the story is about, to my mind. Like, how do you, what are different approaches to being trapped and surrounded by terror?
Right.
You know, and, he was inspired by, you know, he was in Maine. He lives in Maine. And there's this huge thunderstorm where he and his son were in this crowded supermarket after this gigantic thunderstorm and just kind of thinking like, oh, like here's a bunch of people trapped in a disaster.
Yeah.
What if monster?
what if monster?
The bottleness of it, like you could do a very effective, like stage play of this. I feel like,
yes, you could.
Like the appearance of the monsters in the book or the movie are not like, it's cool, but it's not so important to it.
No,
like all good. It reminds me of zombie fiction in that where like the downfall is people.
Right.
It's, you know, it's not the threat outside. It's the threat inside.
Right. You know, the thing that pushes them out is a particularly dangerous person who has managed to gather influence. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is like any good piece of apocalyptic fiction in that way. And obviously there have been works like this before it, but this is actually a really influential story as well in that regard. You know, like a lot of King's work tends to be. This book is a bit of a departure for King, who normally writes in this, you know, omniscient third person kind of view. You know, a narrator that only reveals what's going on in somebody's head when it is important to the story. This, it's kind of an apocalypse log. It's being written after the fact from the perspective of the main character, who's an artist named David Drayton. I don't think this is used to particularly good effect in the book.
To me, it seems that the idea is this is part of like a general Lovecraftiness of this story.
Yes.
Like this is a very Lovecraftian story, and this being somebody's, you know, diary after the event, you know, I'm writing this down so other people can see it and go on like, that's, you know, Lovecraft as fuck. You know, so like it seems like that's all kind of part of a piece with the story being, you know, quite so like, you know, Lovecraftian and Eldritch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Lovecraft is even like name checked in this, you know. It's you know, it's really intentional on that part. When I say it's not used to very good effect, I think it is used for an awful lot of tell don't show in some instances, which is generally not something that he does.
Yeah, that's my biggest quibble with the book versus the movie is that the book has the main character coming to conclusions that I want the reader to come to.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot. It doesn't ruin anything. Like I think this is a thing where I think the book or the movie is a hair better than the book, but they're both really good. Like reading the book was excellent.
Yeah.
You know, And I actually dipped into, I did Reddit on my my e-reader, but then also had that linked up to my Audible thing. So parts of it, I listened to the audiobook of it, which is read by Sanderson. The guy, is it Sanderson? The guy who plays one of the stock boys who initially converts over to...
Oh, he plays Myron. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he reads it and he's excellent.
Nice.
So it was really cool to go back. Like it does really work. And I've heard there's a really good audio play version of this as well. That Mai was telling me about on the Slack.
Nice.
And said that it is just like, you know, all the sound effects and everything happen, but it's a complete audio work.
Yeah, those are really good. I like that a lot. I'm hoping to find a Stephen King book that is treated like that. However, they are so long that they end up being pretty straight reads.
Yeah, you find it in a thrift store on 17 CDs, you know, like, it's a, you know, unfolds forever, like Myst 5, you know, like something like that.
So like I said, this is a very influential story. I could, you know, like the Wikipedia actually lists a whole bunch of video games that take off of this, which is good, even, you know, including like Silent Hill is a very obvious kind of example of this, the idea of a foggy Silent Hill, etc. And this is a book that, like, when people ask, like, how do I get started with Stephen King, that's what I point them toward, because it is so breezy. It is so
and
it's, you know, so compact. There's a lot of action in it. There's a lot of character development, a lot of like interaction. It's just very like a good fundamental book that, like, gets you into, if not his normal style, at least his tone, right? It is a good story.
Yeah, the hook is really great for it. I mean, it's very, like, again, you know, it feels like what you do with these kind of horror, you know, kind of bottled up, you know, works, like a lot of times in zombie fiction. But you have the people turn evil by dealing, you know, not turn evil, turn dangerous by dealing with horror in different ways. And this is a really, like, feels very textbook version of that. And that's again, that's not damning. It's like, is like doing this pretty much perfect, like hitting every note in how you do that. Like all the different articulations of fear are hit and pretty well developed. And it is, you know, for somebody who is sometimes put off by the wordiness, like this is a, goes so quick.
Yeah,
it is. And I would also say, some of the, chapters I've read, cause I didn't read this from my copy of Skeleton Crew that I have, but I have read some of the stories in that, and like, don't get the standalone version of this. You should get Skeleton Crew.
Yeah.
Cause you also get some good short stories with it.
Yes, you do. The monkey.
So,
oh man.
Yeah.
Monkey.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very good. Also, it's very short. I think it's like, it's sub 200 pages based on my Kindle version of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is a Dark Tower show, and this is connected to the Dark Tower in some kind of strange ways. So it's an early King work. It was initially published while The Gunslinger was still being released as serialized chapters. So this was in 1980, and The Gunslinger was published between 78 and 82. And so the connections to the towers are kind of retconned. You know, King has actually said that he's pulled, you know, like when he when he was looking for places for the story to go, or kind of mechanics for the cosmos, he pulled these concepts from The Mist because he liked it so much forward, you know, into the Dark Tower, so that he could use them. But that also provides some, you know, retroactive explanation as to exactly what happened here in this short story. Gary, you'll remember when we did the Try This About the Gunslinger comic, which covers some of the stuff from book four. You'll remember the concept of a thinny?
Yes, that like kind of mist that moved through that canyon.
Yes.
Like that fog that kind of moved through there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's one of the concepts that's introduced here a little bit. The mist itself is a combination of that and the Toad Ash space. So a thinny is a place where the fabric of reality is kind of worn thin. Think like, you know, the knee of your jeans sometimes, right? Allowing things to pass through. It actually manifests as this warbling, silvery fog. The Quartet passes through one of them to the setting of the Stand in book four. Kind of introducing, not introducing, but actually like bringing, making practical the idea that the Dark Tower encompasses, you know, kind of several different levels. Different floors of the tower, right, which act as different dimensions. And between those towers, you know, outside, between those floors outside of the wall, you have this thing called Toad Ash space, which is this place outside of creation where the things that do not fit within creation, these beasts of the prim or the great ones, dwell. So by going to a dash, it lets you travel far distances and across dimensions. Sometimes it happens unintentionally as well. But it's dangerous because the darkness encroaches and, you know, these monsters, the ones, you know, from the mist will start seeking you out when you are there and outside of the protection of the tower.
Extremely from beyond or Hound of Tenaldos kind of thing.
Yes.
Like hunt you down. And that gives, you know, that makes sense for this because that seems, you know, that's more or less what seems to have happened, you know, is that this, this mist, this thing came through and these outsider creatures, you know, these things from Todash space make their way in.
Yes.
You know, these things feel like outsiders, especially later, like, you know, they start out in smaller scale, but again, that's very from beyond, like, you know, these little bat creatures and insect creatures moving on to these, you know, abominations.
Yeah. I love the implied ecology between them.
Yeah. Yeah. They interact in a way that's really great.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Todash and Thinnies end up being incredibly important for, books. Let's see here, 4, 5, and 6, not so much 7. But yeah, it's there. Additionally, Roland ends up going to the town of Bridgeton, Maine, I think in book 7. And even, there's a shootout in the pharmacy, that we see here in a different version of that pharmacy, I should say.
Yeah. So it is not before this happened. It's in like an alternate universe version of the pharmacy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yep. So let's talk about this thing. Let's go through this, cool and compact story.
Yeah. I love the way the chapters are titled in the book, because it is like him outlining it. You know, he's writing this for other people to kind of do an account of this outlandish thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And it's like he's outlining it for himself.
Yes.
You know, so it ends up kind of, you know, does what an outline does. It prepares the reader for it as well. And we start out with the coming of the storm.
Yeah. Yeah. Where we're introduced to some of the main players, right? We have David, who's this artist. We have Stephanie, his wife, and his son, Billy. I love Billy. It's really sad to see what he goes through in this.
Yeah, Big Bill.
Yeah, yeah. Big Bill, right at 100 times, you know, like a student being punished, right?
Yeah.
And then also our good friend, the son of a bitch, Brent Norton.
Yes. And it's introducing, it feels like to me the important part of this is, other than just introducing that family dynamic, is introducing, and this is probably something that if you read a lot of Stephen King's work, you're already familiar with, but it definitely seems like something that is not part of my daily life is that this like very New England, us and them kind of set up, you know, multiple times he references, not just in terms of Brent Norton, but in terms of other people like outsider summerers, you know, people who are just here a little while. And Brent Norton is that he's an outsider who is not a local, and is big city ways, you know, there's a little like big, you know, country mouse, city mouse stuff going on with this dude.
Yeah. He's a big city lawyer from Manhattan.
Well, now I'm a big city lawyer and I'm here to say that, well, this is just a farce. We got to get out of here.
Oh man, no self-respect to Manhattan. I would use non-instant grits.
they're setting up their dynamic and essentially their history, where at some point there was a property dispute that David won.
Yes.
And Brent is convinced that the only reason why he won is because you small town fuckers stick together. Your hillbilly code.
Yeah.
I cannot get through it. They're kind of hanging out and they start getting this the signs of the storm.
Right. Right. Like they see a water spout moving along the lake that they live by.
Yeah.
In a house that should not be like there's a reason that houses were not built on this side of the lake, because the wind comes and picks it up. And so they go in, you know, like they have been outside because of this terrible heat wave. But this is the storm that kind of sets things off. Right. As, you know, it comes in and just wrecks up the entire town. You know, David's favorite tree is falling through the living room window. And he kind of has this premonition dream about God trampling through Bridgeton and leaving smoke behind him.
Yes. Yeah. He does have some on the nose dreams.
Yes.
Is it me? I'm sure you guys have talked about this a lot. And I'm not going to turn this into a parody thing. I don't like how he portrays his wife in this. Is that like a standing thing? Like, I think that he makes her seem like naggy and dumb at points, and I didn't like it.
I didn't pick that up. Yeah, so sometimes it's a little rough.
It's not beyond the pale, right? Like, he's not like, you know, that dumb you know, the dumb idiot was real worried about her couch.
Yeah.
But the way he, like, the way he chooses to have, like, her concerns come through as, like, always being kind of trivial and material and everything, I just had this feeling of, like, being a little bit off put by it.
Yeah.
You know, and then later, like, you know, and because I'd only read the, or seen the movie, I hadn't read it. And then later, like, he cheats on her. It's a, you know, expression of fear of death, number 43, lowercase b or whatever, you know, like getting horny because it's the end, you know, you might not be able to get a chance to do it again.
Right. Right.
You know, so it was a little bit like his relationship to his wife, like, felt a little weird to me.
Yeah.
In this, like, there's some stuff that's very good with it, but it's all physical. Like, the way that she talks is, like, I don't know. There's a weird element to it to me.
Yeah. I can't go to bat for every depiction of women that Stephen King has done, because God knows he has problems with that. What I will say is he generally has gotten better about it. Again, this is very, very early on. There's an arc over his career where you can separate, like, oh, this was a young man who really didn't have anything writing about the stuff, as opposed to writing with the weight of experience or with a certain amount of care that comes from a more mature perspective as a writer who has a wife who has children. So, like, those depictions generally get much, much better. Reading this, that didn't really stick out. I generally thought they had a pretty solid loving relationship between them.
It's not beyond the pale or anything. Yeah. It's just kind of like like her being portrayed as kind of like a, you know, real concerned with the furniture felt very, like, felt super two-dimensional to me.
Yeah,
yeah. In a weird way. Like, and that's the detail I remember, but I got the impression in more ways than that. But I can definitely see it if it's something where it's like, you don't, I'm writing a husband-wife, and it's important to the plot that he really love his wife. Mm-hmm. It's not important that she be a character, because she's not. Like, she disappears in the book. She's not part of the story, really.
Right, right.
You know, she ends up being a factor. She's like a motivation, but she's not a player.
Right, right.
You know? So it ends up making a kind of sense, but it's just something I noticed in these opening chapters. Not so much the Coming of the Storm one, but in the next chapter.
Yeah. I do like the way that pays off, though, because he's like, oh, come on, it's all insured. And he's like, but still, it's going to suck. And then it turns out that he comes around to her point of view, like, actually, yeah, it doesn't matter if it's insured because of, you know, X, Y, or Z. And it's hilarious that comes home to him when he realizes that Norton's Thunderbird has been crushed.
Yeah.
What was that insured? Oh yeah, it's insured just like your boathouse was. Fuck. No,
well, fuck. Yeah. bonding a little bit is nice.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of him kind of coming around on it. And it's written from his perspective. So
Yeah.
So in the aftermath, Billy's all excited about this, like a little kid would be, you know, really energized by the apocalypse, right? You know, going crazy about the boathouse, loves carrying notes back and forth between his mom and his dad, bringing his dad beer, stealing sips, all of that.
Yep. And his son, I like that I do like the relationship between him and his son quite a bit.
Yes.
Like that's real well developed. And I like his son being, you know, there's a refreshing lack of, like, macho bullshit between him and his son.
Right.
You know, like, this is a little boy, you know, like he can be kind of like terrified and scared, and, like, you know, the dad kisses him a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, you don't really see people write about stuff like that. Like, generally father son relationships are written much more brusquely.
Yes.
Than that. I really like that detail.
Yeah. Like he's pretty much always carrying Bill. He's always, you know, he's always, you know, making sure that Bill is, you know, seen to. At no point does he say, like, hey, toughen up.
Yeah, exactly. This is, you know, it carries a sense of stakes that at no point does he act like things are normal. Mm-hmm. You know, people around him do for various reasons, but he's the one sane person who's, like, reacting appropriately to any of this.
Right. Right.
You know,
You know, so as he's surveying this destruction, David starts thinking of Mrs. Carmody, this eccentric antiques dealer who his wife really seems to like. You know, she's got all of these, you know, folklore remedies, and it's kind of always speaking doom, right? So the doomsayer, talking about the blizzard of 88. They bring up this event that happened a couple years ago, this black spring, where in the middle of the spring the lake froze over with this black ice, and nobody really seemed to be able to find a real explanation for this. I love the beat later on where he's talking about his his buddy, who says, like, oh, it's because of the Arrowhead Project over there in Shaymore, where they're shooting atoms into the air. Well, the air is full of atoms. Well, these are different atoms.
Yeah, these are different kinds of atoms. And that's in response to Billy.
Yeah.
Billy corrects him, which I love, like, kids using grade school science to correct adults.
Yep.
And it's like, no, these are different atoms. That's heavily implied to be what's going on.
Right, right.
Here, explicitly in the movie, heavily implied in the book.
Yes.
I mean, like, very heavily, like, there's not really a doubt. One of the things where I've seen, like, where people have written essays comparing the two, Tasha Robinson, who used to write for the AV Club, wrote one, and she was like, I'm disappointed that the movie spells out what caused the incident. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how do you not feel like the book does?
Oh, it's like, so apparent.
Nobody says it, but it is, there's no doubt.
It is the likeliest of things, right?
Yes. And if it's not, it's so weird that they constantly are talking about this, like this project that has nothing to do with things. Like, right. Everyone's just talking about it. Just a catchy set of syllables. It has nothing to do with the mist, you know?
Like, it's a dance sensation that's sweeping this town. Yeah,
everyone's doing the funky Arrowhead. So that's definitely what's going on. And this does not feel like ham-handed foreshadowing to me.
No.
It's slice of life stuff. There's a couple things where he's just like, for no reason, I thought about this, but that doesn't ring as false because it's like, it's literally a running log of everything he talked about. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's writing it in retrospect.
Right.
So it's like the fact that he's writing about this after all of it happened, it's more like him just being like, yeah, you know what? Like, that was a little bit weird. That maybe was on my mind. There's a little bit of like unreliable memory stuff to my mind.
Yeah.
That is more responsible for him foreshadowing everything that's going to come up.
Yeah.
Than just straight up foreshadowing.
Yeah. The first time I read this, I was put off by the foreshadowing, but you've hit on something exactly right. Like the unreliable memory, the framing things up as a story, as opposed to a string of just events, is a thing of journaling, you know?
Yeah. Right. You know, It makes sense for him to, since this is written on hotel stationery this would be how it articulates. So so we find out, you know, that this tree fell over in the storm, it crushed his boathouse, which we mentioned, and as he's kind of checking this out, he sees this mist over the lake, and it has this strange right angle. It is like there is just bam, wall of mist,
yeah,
and then clarity,
yeah, and it's moving against the wind as well.
Yeah Super spooky.
Man is the inventor of straight edges.
Yeah, this is not natural.
Yeah. But sure. He writes it off like, huh, well, this is a town full of strange stuff.
There's been weather, there's been mist off the lake. You know, he brings it up with his family and they're like, you know, there's been mist off the lake before.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, this is different. And it's like, well, you know, doesn't seem that different.
Where's the rainbow, Gary? Gary, where's the rainbow?
If this story had been called The Rainbow and is about these monsters coming out of a rainbow,
I would also read
a very different story. Like I'd be down with that. Like, yeah. Just like different kinds of rainbows.
There are colors we were not meant to see at the end of the rainbow. Big
Daga, you know, like, just remember Roy G. Big Daga.
He hears his neighbor. He hears Norton cursing over his chainsaw, trying to get it to start. This is hilarious in the movie. It's kind of menacing in the book. Because a seemingly unstable person with a chainsaw, without the context of like, oh, he's just this big goofy guy, it reads a little bit like, what's going on here? But he goes over to get the insurance information, and they, you know, again commiserate over the T-Bird being crushed.
Yeah, like that's a big enough deal that even though I hate this guy, I don't want to have him.
I'm sorry, man. I really mean it.
Yeah, that's gotta suck. They're going to head into town.
Yeah.
At this point, they're going to market. And he's like, you know, and Norton's like, do you mind if I come along?
I need beer.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this had a rough thing. So they're doing this trip.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to get ready to take this trip, the three of them.
Yeah. So they load up Billy into the car. Norton stops to ogle Stephanie. Mm-hmm. And they get on down the way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the last time that David has seen his wife.
Yeah, he mentions that explicitly. He sees her one more time in the ending of the movie, which we'll have to talk about.
Yes.
When we get there. But for here, it is the last time.
Yes.
And they get to the grocery store. They see, you know, cars parked outside. There's a little bit of like blocking information that seems extraneous at first and then actually comes up.
Yeah.
A little bit later. And the, Mrs. Carmody's out there and she's in front of the store. She has this flashy yellow pantsuit on.
The queen in yellow.
Yeah. Nobody can use the phone. The phones are out. And we're introduced to this, the people who run the store, Bud Brown, who is the manager, who is this real tight ass.
He's the he's calls him the Charles de Gaulle of running a supermarket.
Yeah. And then Ollie Weeks, who is like a bag boy, who is really solid and played by like a 70-year-old man in the movie. Not quite, but he's played by, what's that guy's name?
He's a notable character actor who's in a bunch of Darabont stuff. I can pull this up. Yeah. I can do don't worry.
I think he turned, like, he's in, he's Armin Zola. Yep. In Captain America 2.
Uh-huh.
And he plays a bag boy. It's like very like, yeah. Oh, buddy.
He's
like,
supposed to be
Shawshank.
Yeah. I mean, this is where books went. I need to actually go and immediately watch that movie to see if he went to Bridgeton or if that was Castle Rock. It's Toby Jones, noted character actor. I don't think he's a bag boy. I think that he's the assistant manager, actually.
Is he a bag boy in the book? Then where'd I get bag boy from?
I don't know. He was standing by the checkout in the movie and also in the book. But I think he is explicitly an assistant manager because he's like the only person who can go to Bud and say, you know, fuck you.
I pictured him as young in the book and, you know, and he was not in the movie. Like, I thought of him as a younger guy and maybe it was a misconception I got, and it made him kind of getting it and like, hey, these rules are no longer apply.
Mm-hmm.
When Bud Brown didn't get it, it like made it a little bit better.
Yeah.
You know, this young guy being like, come on, dad.
Yeah.
You
know, in the book he's described as being like real heavy, and being real shy, like turned inward. Like David says, I get the sense that he's, you know, afraid of women. Right. Mm-hmm. Just like not really, doesn't really have his stuff together, but like, I love Ollie's story and the way that he's presented in this, because his reaction to fear is to become the best version of himself. You know, like, he rises to the occasion in a way that kind of only David does.
Yeah.
You know, he is the other voice of reason in this.
Yes. Yeah. He gets a couple, you know, a couple people who join up and are also kind of co-heroes in this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the coming of the mist, chapter 3.
Yeah. It's a very brief chapter because, as Billy is pointing out, the fact that there's some army guys here in the store, they hear this terrible shrieking, this police siren, you know, fires off in the distance, you know, some storm sirens, etc., and a man runs out of the encroaching fog that is rolling in from, you know, Kansas Street, saying something's in the fog, you know, something is in the fog. This is a guy who's played by the actor who played Dale on from The Walking Dead in the movie,
another Frank Darabont, like, you know, cohort.
Yeah
that kind of guy. And he's got like a broken nose.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in the book, like, he's bleeding.
Yes.
He runs out of the fog. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Carmody immediately is just like, there's death out there. One thing I'll say about the audiobook version of this is that his voice for Mrs. Carmody is so over the top as to be distracting in the extreme. It's like, is death out there? Like, makes her like a real like gravelly witch.
Yeah.
In a way like that is incredibly intense.
Yeah. And she, like, she's only portrayed as the witch in the book. In the movie, she's played by, Marcia Harden from Miller's Crossing. You would recognize her. She's a little bit younger. But in the book, she is very much like, you know, if you're coming at this from the tower, she is very much like a Rhea of the Coast kind of feel, or like a Sylvia Pitson.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's very much like a literal witch.
Yeah.
And I think because I'd watched the movie first, it kind of influenced me more to think of her as like, no, just kind of a nutcase, you know, like a little bit more shrill, a little bit less like, you know, a little less goblinoid than he voices her. It's very funny.
Yeah.
But regardless of which, she's like, you know, leaping on this, like, it's immediate right from the beginning that like she's opportunistic.
Yeah.
In the face of this tragedy. Like, it's really gross.
Yeah. It's pretty rough. What I love about her character is she doesn't change in any of this. Like, she immediately, you know, she probably snapped 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Based on something with her. She doesn't change. Everybody else comes around to her.
Yeah, right? Yeah. people start. And maybe it was during, you know, one of these other events, too, when she snapped. Like, not the 1888, because that's too long ago, but there's a couple of references. Ooh. It could be any time. References to these other kind of, like, bigger disasters or something like that. So who knows where she lost it?
Yeah.
But as this happens, and people start running out of the store because everything's gone crazy, he sees something grab somebody and lift them upwards.
Mm-hmm.
And mist is such a good idea for this thing to kind of permeate everything, because it's the same reason you shoot like horror at night.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't have to see it clearly. If you just see somebody's body and you can barely see it, and then you just see it lift, like that's terrifying, you know, and real good. Like your imagination is just going to fill all that in.
Yeah. And also the mist obscures sound in this as well. So they never get a sense, I mean, until they're out of the building and like driving on the roads, of exactly what scale these things are at.
Yeah.
I would really like to we told ourselves we wouldn't focus on the movie, but I think it's kind of impossible. This is one of the few Blu-rays I would be tempted to buy, because I guess the preferred version of this is in black and white. Darabont wanted to present this entirely in black and white, kind of as an homage to Night of the Living Dead. And apparently that is what he considers canonical. I think that would actually really help the appearance of the monsters, which I think have not aged very well. It doesn't matter. So it's not a deal breaker, but like that would kind of ease that a bit.
I think so too.
Yeah. So it's a real problem.
Yeah.
The people rushing out, including a woman who needs to go and be with her kids. This ends up being somebody who survives in the movie, in that ending, which we have to talk about. And we get into the next chapter, the storage area, problems with the generators, and what happened to the bag boy.
Yes. So everyone's kind of like snapping into roles here.
Right.
You know, trying to figure out like what to do. Like Norton is trying to keep people together.
Yeah.
Like he's logical. He's a big city. What does he know? He's a big city guy. Yeah. trying to use his logic and lawyering skills to keep everybody together.
Right.
And the generator's making weird noises. So David, you know, same way you're a disaster, like everyone wants to be useful, mm-hmm. right? Like this is the kind of thing I would do. Like, you know, I'm at the store, I'll go fix this because what else the fuck else am I going to do? Like go boil some water,
right.
You know, like you have to have something to do.
Right.
And he hears this like crazy sound outside the loading door.
Yeah. He describes it later on. It's like wind through the ivy.
Yeah.
As somebody who has ivy right outside of his bedroom window. Yep. but yeah, like he hears it and he freaks out and he's like, okay, I need to go get some help. And he brings kind of the worst people, you know, back to it. You know, he's got Ollie there. Who's like, yeah, the generator, you know, the power's out, but you know, the food will keep, like it's fine. It doesn't really matter. And these tough guys, like these two mechanics and the bag boy, they're like, well, fuck it. Let's go out. Let's clear that blockage on the vent. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Grocery toughs. and you know, he expresses a little bit of trepidation about that. And as they open the door to do so, a tentacle comes in and grabs the bag boy.
Yep. Grabs the young kid and starts whipping him toward the door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they go through. There's a very specific part in here where it grabs a bag of dog food.
Yes.
At some point and crushes it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that like detail, because it's like the kind of thing you'd notice in this. Like, is it the most important thing happening right now? No.
Nope.
But you're going to like focus in on those kind of details in a crisis.
I made a particular note of one of the tentacles grabbing a 2 liter of Pepsi.
What is delicious? Like it's, monsters need a refreshment, Cole.
I suppose it's a little bit like if you're going to pick up a pizza and it's like, fuck it, I'll grab a 2 liter. It's fine.
Yeah. It's got kids to feed.
It's like a sweet, sweet Pepsi to feed it.
Yeah. I want to see this monster drink a Pepsi. Like whatever this is attached to, like very much so.
Oh man. And these tentacles have little mouths on the end of it. Like it's eating him as it constricts him. Right.
Drinking like a lot of little Pepsis. Like what if that was the thing that happened in the movie when they left? Like they drove through and it's playing that song and it drives through the back and it shows the monster just drinking Pepsi to the like,
the taste of a new generation.
Yes, the new generation.
Oh gosh.
So David's trying to help him.
Right, trying to pull him in, but it's futile, you know. I love this reaction because David has tried to warn them off, saying like, hey, I heard something. It's not a good idea to open that up. I don't know, like I understand that you guys, you see a problem and you need to fix it, but this is a bad idea. Norm's reaction is not to like say like, help me, you idiot, help me. It is like to apologize, but also to admonish Dave. Like you did not express yourself clearly when you said you heard something. I thought you meant a bird.
Or like, you know, you didn't express like, this is your fault.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry, but you fucked up. And it's like, that's very natural.
Yeah.
You know, as he's getting dragged outside, you know, and as it's happening, the loading door closes and severs one of the tentacles.
Right.
And David just starts punching the grocery toughs.
Yeah. Starts unloading, like, hey, yeah, you know, like, you
almost fucking killed that kid.
Yeah.
You idiots.
Right. Yeah. And Ollie stops and saying, like, hey, Dave, they didn't twist Norm's arm. You have to remember that. Like, yeah, he went on his own volition, you know?
Yeah.
So, and neither of them want to really think about what those tentacles were
what this
attached
means.
To.
There are tentacles in play.
Yeah.
So, like, uh-oh. All tentacles.
Yeah.
So it moves on to the next chapter. An argument with Norton, a discussion near the beer cooler, verification.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So Ollie at this point says, like, hey, if we actually saw that, we're fucked because the entire front of this store is glass.
Yeah.
You know,
going back to the exact inspiration of this, like,
yeah,
Stephen King looking at the glass doors and the grocery store he's trapped in.
Yeah. And then he also looked at it and said, okay, we're going to have to remember this later if we need to verify something on the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
which of these is a shop front right there? Okay, we're good. I also like the biddy who comes up and, like, they've gotten into the beer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Bud Brown's a real.
Yeah.
A real wiener about that during this whole thing too.
Yeah.
You know, people drinking, but it makes sense. Like,
yeah. Well, and Ollie's drinking too, but he's sweating it out faster than he can get drunk.
Ollie can't get drunk. He's got a healing factor in this.
Right.
Like, it is it's called being fat. And I understand it's like a fat assistant manager at times of my life. I can also not get drunk because I sweat.
So Norton refuses to believe what David is saying. David thinks that he has an ally in Norton, but their old conflict is not as behind them as David had initially thought, right? Norton is disagreeing, refusing to acknowledge this, as if his sanity depends on it, is what David observes.
Yeah, it is specifically, he's just like, yeah, you guys are trying to prank me.
Right.
Like, this isn't one of Ashram Ketchum's prompts. Like, and the... It's just crazy. Like, you know, David is just saying, like, no, like, what is more likely that I, like, you know, during all of this, I had the foresight to bring a rubber tentacle that I'm going to bring, you know, and it's obvious that he doesn't actually believe it. He just, you know, he knows he's lying to himself.
Right. Right.
You know, and he's just like, we don't have to. It's exactly like, we don't have to actually argue about this. Right. You know, it's like he has a smartphone. Like, we can just look this up.
Right.
There's no reason to debate anything. We all have supercomputers in our pocket.
Right.
And that's what the tentacle in the back room is the equivalent of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, Norton, you know, goes on a rant, like, oh, we come here, we, you know, like, we pay property taxes, we make your economy, I could buy and sell you, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep. Yeah.
So, Ollie, knowing that people are going to come over anyway, says, like, hey, everybody needs to come hear what David has to say. You know, like, there's no sense in us hiding this, but Mrs. Carmody uses this as an opportunity to do more of her doomsaying. As you know, David takes Bud Brown, the only person who will actually follow him, back to see the tentacle, which makes him vomit.
Yeah. And Bud Brown is given Ollie shit about drinking beer at this point too. I think this is where that threat happens.
Yeah.
Where he's like, I'm gonna report you to corporate, and he's like, you know what? If we get out of this, you can report me to corporate. Like, you know, like, the two kinds of people in the mist are people who understand that they're fucked and people who don't.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And then with all of the authority of the supermarket manager, Bud comes out and says, people, it appears we have a problem of some magnitude here.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. You know, great, great line, great understatement. there. So, that moves into the next chapter. One of the things too, just, and since we're kind of talking about differences with the movie as we go, is that, like, Mrs. Carmody is much more of like a side, kind of like a side character during the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, becomes kind of a threat quicker in the movie.
Yeah.
And is much more like present in every scene and has more lines.
Yeah.
And everything in the book, like, it is, she's kind of a nuisance until all of a sudden she's not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a criticism. Like, it's insidious.
Yes.
You know, like, people don't turn to her really gradually in the books.
No.
Or in the book, people just kind of like, well, I'm all out of things to turn to, you know, whereas it's much more kind of gradual. She, like, picks up followers slowly after every incident in the movie. So it's kind of a different treatment of them, you know, and she's got a much stronger religious angle in the movie. When the movie came out, actually, some people, like, protested it because of her portrayal, which is, to me, is, you know, is pretty bonkers.
A little bit,
but Yeah. But people, you know, protested her portrayal because she's much more explicitly like Christian Doomsay as opposed to old witch who like fought off Hansel and Gretel Doomsay, right, like she is in the book.
Yeah. You know, they take some of the stuff from the next to last chapter in this, you know, her lines about expiation, and sprinkle that throughout the entire movie as it goes. You know, people are watching her as a curiosity at the start, but like you said, each scene kind of has her with, you know, a couple more people in her, in her thrall, you know, until they are like explicitly worshiping alongside of her here.
Yes.
Here it is described like she never stops talking. You know, they say like, oh, like she's like Castro, she's filibustering.
Yeah. It's just, it's not paid as much attention to as it is in the movie. So it's an interesting kind of difference. You know, the way they kind of take care of those things.
Yeah. For the person who ends up being like the villain of the book.
Or
of the, of the story.
Yeah.
So speaking of her, people start breaking out into factions. You know, she only has the, you know, the herself at this point, but she is trying to curry favor. You know, David says something like, oh, you're going to see the, you know, the same thing in any New England town meeting, which again is one of those slice of life details. Obviously people are going to break down like this. Norton is leading the flat earthers, which is what David calls them, you know, who do not acknowledge that there are monsters outside who are trying to find a way to, you know, get out, and, you know, amass enough so they can go home.
Or get help.
Right.
You know, they even say like, you know, we'll send help if like, for this disaster, this is a natural disaster.
Right.
You know? And David's not having it. Like, he's like, you know, where would he even go? Like, is the Eastern seaboard gone? Like, is there a Portland, Maine? Like, is there, you know, any of these things? Like, do these things exist anymore?
Yeah.
And the another faction is Miss Carmody, is, you know, kind of on her own, like a faction of one at this point.
Yeah.
And people, you know, people are curious, like, hey, what are you proposing? And she's like, hey, you have to get ready to meet God. and it's like, oh, that's pretty fucked up. And she's like, yeah, and we need a blood sacrifice. And it's like, well, you okay. You had me at the first part.
All right.
You know,
that particular lot's not moving right now. Let's come back in a day. I'll come back and see if that's that's going to a discount. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll circle back on your blood sacrifice, lady. and then again, in that like go boil water, which is like one of the, my favorite things that pops up in this is like, you know, they're like, hey, what if we put some of these like soil in front of the windows?
Yeah.
And it's like, they know that's not, you know, they saw the tentacle. They even say like, you know, I saw it crush this bag of dog food. Like, this window is not going to stop it. The soil is not going to stop it. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever it's attached to. But like, it's just going to make people feel better.
Right. Right.
You know, like it's an illusion of security and an illusion of purpose are the two things that these people need.
Yeah. So they, you know, use the bags of dog food and the plant food as kind of sandbags at the front, and you know, just shore up this glass window, and they leave loopholes and set watches, you know, to make sure nothing big is coming, as if they would be able to do anything about it. Like, they even set aside like brooms and torches, or brooms and mops to use as torches with lighter fluid.
Yeah.
Yep. So
they ask if anybody has a gun. Somebody says they have a gun out in their car, and he's like, do you want me to go get it? And he's like, no. And he's like, okay, I just thought I'd ask. Like,
yep.
I didn't want to, but you know, I would have. but a woman named Amanda has a revolver in her purse, which her husband gave her.
Right.
And there's a little bit of back and forth about like, you know, if you were going to be gone for, you know, because he's gone on business
right
all the time. Like, if you were going to have a wife like that, you wouldn't want to be gone on business all the time.
Right. Yeah, so Ollie is the one who picks it up and says, hey, I can shoot this. I've won contests and things like that. So, okay, the gun has a capable user here. And David even knows, like upon seeing this, is like, oh, the sensation I get seeing a totally unsuspected Ollie Weeks, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Billy is not doing too great in this, as you would expect a five-year-old to, you know, to do. He is kind of regressing. You know, he misses his mom. He heartbreakingly apologizes to David for all the times he wasn't good to his mom.
Yeah. Which is pretty hard, you know, pretty rough.
Yeah. Well, Norton and the flat earthers, they make a big stink about like, hey, we're going to leave. If you want to come with us, come with us.
Yeah. You know, they go out and he says like, hey, like at least let me, tie this clothesline to you, you know, cause I want to see how far you can get out, you know, there. And like this makes a dramatic thing that happens. I'm not totally clear on the motivation or like why it helps to have this clothesline. He doesn't sell it very well. He's like, oh, this is 100 yards of clothesline, so if it runs taut, I'll know the 100 yards is safe,
right?
Or something like that. Like, it's a little like what ends up paying off from it is cool, but the setup doesn't make any sense to me.
It is done specifically to get that payoff. of, yeah. you know, they get out the line of slack, and then immediately starts pulling tight.
Yeah.
And then ultimately
start asking my friends when they leave, if I can like tie clotheslines to them just to see.
Yeah.
Just, you know,
just to see if they would say yes. Product.
Yeah. Like,
you just want to see how many questions they would ask.
Yeah. Just like, let us go. Okay. You can go, but let me do this. You know, let me have this one thing.
Right.
But the big thing is it reels out taut and then comes back, you know, bloody, like you said.
Right. Right. As opposed to in the movie where it comes back with somebody's entire, let's say pelvis and legs.
Like yeah.
somebody like bit the top half off of them. Like it was a Kit Kat bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're, everyone's unnerved.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty fucked up. They go into the first night, which is this chapter, and the person who's on watch, like nobody's really sleeping.
No.
The person who's on watch starts freaking out because this like fly thing has landed on the glass.
Ugh, it's described as really fleshy too.
Yeah.
Which I do not want my flying creatures to be. It's fleshy. It's got all these proboscis, stingers, yeah. or sexual organs. It looks like a minor creature in a Bosch painting is what David says. Yeah. And you know, David concludes like, okay, well, we can only see out the loopholes. We have to assume that they are just, swarming over the entire building, like just yeah. clinging to it. Like, you know, like, I don't know, like you ever see that animated GIF or that video of the wall of Daddy Longlegs?
Yeah.
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 I'm just picturing, kind of just picturing the building breathing with these, and I'm not, this is a pretty upsetting chapter to me, actually.
Yeah.
I don't like bugs in general, specifically insects, things, or bees.
Yeah, this is a cool chapter because like both and I keep bringing up the movie because it's like the comparisons are interesting.
Yeah.
Both articulations of it are interesting.
Yes.
Like it's a way bigger disaster in the movie.
Yes.
Like it is much more chaotic and fucks everything up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, but here it's like they do a much better job of like kind of the creeping terror of this. Like when the actual thing kind of swoops in. So after they're looking at this bug, a bird like this, like, you know, Silent Hill ass pterodactyl, mm-hmm. Comes down and grabs one of the flies and ends up crashing through the window.
Yeah.
And everyone freaks out.
So that's the ecology. The bugs were attracted to the light. The birds were attracted to the bugs. They were just following their food source. And then the bigger stuff is attracted to the smell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So they, David ends up setting the bird thing on fire with this, this mop torch.
Yeah. Which seems very hard to control.
Yeah. Yeah. That's and it is in the movie, like it's very difficult to do this.
Yeah. It's setting whole shelves on fire.
Yeah. It's starting fires. He can't get lit. He ends up just stabbing it. You know, it's like, it's very difficult. They are much less, equipped.
Yeah.
It's like this raid thing. I have real mixed feelings on.
It's a little,
it's a dumb comedy beat in the middle of this horror story.
Yeah. Like this character, this old woman who kills the smaller bug that gets in, with raid. She ends up becoming like the bug spray lady. Like she also does something very similar when they make the excursion to the pharmacy. It feels like something in It where it only works because she believes it's going to work.
Yeah. Like this is acid,
right?
This is battery acid. Like I think in the movie, if I recall, and they're both blending together a whole lot, but I think she uses a spray thing and then makes a torch,
which is more reasonable.
That makes way more sense than like these things being vulnerable to raid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I'm sure raid's not good for anything, but like it's just working because it's a bug is very weird. And it's like, it's such a goofy comedy thing. Like her, like kind of handling them like a gunslinger, or like their guns, or like she's in the Old West.
Yeah.
Is a real cute, like rapping granny kind of thing, you know, like, I don't know, like, man, grandma's badass. You know, like you get that kind of sense, like, you know, Pauly Shore is going to look to the camera after this and be like, damn, grandma. And then it's going to, you know, cut to Bust a Move or whatever else is in the trailer. Like,
ow, I feel good.
Just, yeah. You know, like, I don't know. I don't like Mrs. Repler. It is a rare misstep in this book.
Yeah. So it's a little funny because it's hard to say. It feels out of place right here. Like there would have been times in this story for comedy during mm-hmm. this, you know, what's that?
Yeah. Well, all those scenes with Mrs. Comedy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I gotcha.
I mean, it wasn't real good. It's just the way it kind of sounds.
Yeah. No, it's fine. So, yeah, I got you. It took me a little bit longer than I would have expected it to, but I got you.
Right.
But yeah, there would have been a place for them to do that during this incredibly tense scene. It's better in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. But it's still cool. The beginning of it, I think, is better in the books. The scene itself is better in the movie.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah. So David tries to sleep after this. And he's kind of plagued by, you know, these dreams about bird, you know, these, the bird creatures eating his family, you know, in front of the broken window. And also he hears Project Arrowhead over and over again, which very on the nose dreams.
Yes.
He's got to touch the shine to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so, and people are eating too. They're like barbecuing chicken and stuff, like, you know, they have to feed everybody.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they've stolen all the sleeping pills.
Right.
You know, so he offers them like a couple bottles, like people are going bonkers on this shit.
Yeah. Which turns bad, because when you have people in a disaster with access to sleeping pills.
Yes.
Yeah. Not great. So David starts eyeing Amanda, you know, he gets the apocalypse hornies.
Yes.
And he has this kind of small moment of reflection, you know, and this makes more sense later on when you realize that this is being written after the fact than it does in the moment, where he's kind of thinking back to his life and doing the summarizing, you know, about his own career as this middling commercial artist who's kind of living in his father's shadow.
Yeah.
Which feels very much like King talking about being a popular writer.
Yeah, this felt very author insert.
Yeah,
to me, that little specific thing.
Yeah.
After he kind of like, you know, woes me a little bit about this, he tries to reassure Billy, you know, and Billy's like, no, things aren't going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Have you been paying attention? If you think this has a happy ending, you have not been paying attention. And that cuts over to the next chapter. What happened with the soldiers? With Amanda, a conversation with Dan Miller. So,
a conversation with Dan Miller sounds like the most boring interview.
It could be a conversation with Dennis Miller. Like, it could be way worse.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah.
The
I said boring, not objectionable.
not like skin crawlingly awful.
Ugh.
Yeah. Not racist. Is he? I assume he's racist. I lump him in with Bill Maher. I think he's had some like mild, like.
He's one of those comedians who went crazy after 9/11. So even if he is not explicitly racist, he is a conservative comedian who has also got this huge Islamophobic streak.
Yes, I knew that there was some Islamophobia stuff going on with that bro.
But, you know, squares and rhombuses. You know, one is a subset of the other, but that is all that I can attest to, because I stopped paying attention to him.
Yeah,
which is the wise thing.
Yeah, don't pay attention to David Dennis Miller. There's a reason why nobody hugged him at the end of Saturday Night Live episodes.
Is that true? Is that in some of the books?
No, I don't think that's in a book. I've noticed it before when I've watched it,
uh-huh.
where he always kind of stands off to the side.
Yeah.
By himself while everyone is hugging, you know, U2. Whatever. So
that's weird how they flew U2 in every single Saturday.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you the musical guest? No, we're just here for hugging.
Living on the edge. Anywho.
Ollie calls David back into the storeroom saying, hey, we've got a problem. And David, you know, kind of can't believe his eyes at first here, looking and seeing two of the soldiers from the nearby base. You know, these just kids have hung themselves, right?
Yes.
You know, from the base where the Arrowhead project was at.
There's a surprising amount of the logistics of how they hang themselves.
There is, because they it's David trying to figure out if somebody killed them. Like if somebody helped them and didn't and hid the fact, right?
Yeah. And it's this whole thing about, because they tied their hands behind their back as well.
Right.
And the idea, I think, to like, so they can't reach up and cut themselves free or whatever.
Right.
So it's like this thing where they have to stand back to back, tie each other's hands, and then like time it out perfectly. They kind of like recreate the scene.
Yeah.
And it's a very detailed, like, double suicide.
Yeah. If the ice hadn't melted long ago, they would have just been patient and used that old trick.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, where they stood on the puddle.
Yeah. And then there's just a puddle.
And there's a fox with some corn.
And all the doors face north. So, yeah.
This soldier's my son.
I can't hang him.
So they hide the bodies under some dog food because they don't want people freaking out, you know, that there's been a death inside. But like we find out later, people are killing themselves. So that is a rough thing.
And I love that bit of like problem solving. Like, we can't let this get out.
Right.
Because this is going to give people ideas. And it's like, we have to hide this. And that's really good instincts.
Right.
So again, like just like disaster, Ollie on the spot with the good disaster instincts.
Yeah. Like hiding them under the dog food because nobody's going to want the dog food. right? Yeah. They're not going to go poking around that.
Not yet.
Yeah. And Ollie, you know, mentions this rumor that he's heard, you know, he's been working at the registers about the experiments of opening doors to new dimensions up there. And there's a goal here that I'm going to read. It's kind of lengthy, but it bears having here. I sometimes do this, Gary.
It's okay. No, you don't have to. It's your show, man.
Children see everything their eyes happen upon, hear everything in their ears range. But if life is the rise of consciousness, then it is also the reduction of input. Terror is the widening of perspective and perception. The horror was in knowing I was swimming down to a place most of us leave when we get out of diapers and into training pants. When rationality breaks down, the circuits of the human brain can overload. Accents grow bright and feverish. Hallucinations turn real. The quicksilver puddle at the point where perspective makes parallel lines seem to interact is really there. The dead walk and talk. A rose begins to sing.
Yeah.
That last part, a rose begins to sing, like that is an image that is essential to the Dark Tower. It's something he's had in his back pocket for a while.
Very much the, you know, the blessing is the mind's inability to correlate all its contents.
Yes.
Thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So then they bang.
David and Ollie? And says,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Good for them.
It is a really weird book, like at this point, because at no point was there a hint, but he's just so fucking capable. And fucking capable.
So he's capable of fucking.
Yeah. Amanda comes up and is like, hey, there's an office up here. It's got a lock. And then they bang down and like she calls out her husband's name.
Yeah. Like she specifically says, like, hey, I saw the way you were looking at me. Like, this may be the last chance that we have. Let's do it right. You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, they are both complicit in an act of adultery, but they have no way of knowing. And it's actually very unlikely that their partners are still alive.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not like a big moral deal. I think I still like as much as this does like cross off a apocalypse apocalypse reaction, I still think I like the movie better where they're just kind of buddies.
Yeah, it simplifies, you know, right?
It simplifies it, and then just like it's just generally less horny in the face of this. Like there's a lot of people like the getting horny when you think you're gonna die thing. Maybe I just haven't experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's a weird trope that I don't even know if I believe it.
Never gotten a fear boner, Butterfield?
Never gotten a fear boner, man.
Huh.
You got a fear boner? Like, do you get what is giving you a fear boner?
No, I'm just. It just seemed like a fun thing to say.
Yeah, like it's got to be a terror boner. I can understand it conceptually. I also could think like, oh, like, you know, there's tons of people around, and none of us have like. You know, we are all worried about imminent death.
Right.
You know, how can I divert my attention? Like, I couldn't wear headphones in this situation, let alone like go down.
Right.
You know, like, so.
Yeah. I don't know. It is mercifully short.
Yeah. It doesn't spend a lot of time on it.
It's
not supposed to be titillating either. It's quick.
It is short and sweet and seems like almost like a necessary function as opposed to, you know, something that is, tangled up,
get the plug up. And then, so the next day, so it's daytime after they have sex and the bugs have died down.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, Miller calls into question just how big these monsters are, you know, talking about how like none of the cars were upset when those people were taken away. And you know, he notices like, hey, you know, some of us may have missed it, but during the fog, the entire building seemed to drop. Like there is some kind of seismic activity. Like there's no way to know, like if we're dealing with something that is like stories tall, you know?
Yeah.
And
just like the idea that these cars are maybe just getting sucked into the mist.
Right.
He says like, you know, they would have disturbed the cars. Like maybe they are just disappearing. That can happen to us as well.
Right.
Like, essentially, this is the beginning of a string of a conversation like we cannot stay here.
Right. Yeah. Miller is an advocate for at least making this kind of like test balloon expedition going over to the pharmacy to see if there are survivors over there, because they would not satisfy themselves like eating, you know, box crackers when they knew that there was a, you know, a grocery store full of fresh food just 20 feet away.
Yeah.
Right. So as they leave under protest, or as they're getting ready to leave, they notice that Mrs. Carmody has two followers, and this will, you know, start a snowball that ultimately gets our main party out of the market.
Yeah.
Billy doesn't want his dad to go to the pharmacy, but David says, "Oh, don't worry, kid. I will risk life and limb to bring you a comic book.
Yeah, I'll get you some Spider-Mans." So they assemble some improvised weapons. They get their group, you know, Mrs. Carmody is saying, don't go. You know, and Amanda, throws a can of peas at her, you know, stop, strikes her on the breast.
Right.
And says like, I know you boned down last night.
Yeah.
Her
fuck sense is keen.
Yeah. She's been sniffing every room. Ugh. Sniffing for clues. they get to the pharmacy. In the pharmacy, there's something in here where they, I think it's in the book, not the movie. They imply that like the air conditioning was out, so they propped the door open.
Yes.
Or something like that. Like that's, and then like, and as a result,
uh-huh.
like this is terrifying. And this is very good in both the book and movie.
Yeah.
As a scene, this is great because it is like, it's, you know, technically a success. they get out there. You know, because one of the other ways too that they justify this, it's a bigger deal in the movie, but was the guy who had his nose broke.
Yes.
Was to get him some medicine as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, we're going to need access to medicine, and this is just a horror show.
Yeah.
Like this is awful.
Well, in the movie, it was somebody who got like these crazy chemical burns in the fight, like in the big bug fight or whatever it is. Here, like it is almost like a secondary concern. Like, oh, there was somebody who was trampled, their leg is broken, we need to get them some painkillers.
Yeah, it's a justification. For something right. they're going to do anyway.
Right, right. But yeah, like they get here and it's super unnerving in both of them. So David picks up a comic book. He gets both Spider-Man and an Incredible Hulk. Jackpot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both. In the real quick trivia in the movie, they wanted to make it a Punisher comic because Thomas Jane, who plays the lead character, was in the Punisher. But he vetoed it because he had such a terrible time in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
So they ended up doing Hellboy because he is friends with Mike Mignola.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. The director of this.
Nice. Yeah.
So,
but he gets this and he notices, hey, there's some like these, like, is somebody throwing a party in here? Is that crepe paper?
Yeah.
It's all like hung all over the place. Oh, it's like silver thread. It looks kind of like the color of the mist. I picked up a Spider-Man comic. Spiders, yes. Party, spider party. Oh no, we need to leave.
It's been a spider party in here. We have to go. The spiders are partying. And the spiders like start shooting webs at them. These spiders attack.
Yeah.
And their webs are corrosive. Like they dig through, and the work down here is really great. Like they're just showing it like digging through these people's like pants.
Yeah.
And through their socks, like digging into their skin.
Yeah. Like it's one of them by severing his femoral artery.
Yeah.
Is the thing. Like they describe it as like the sensation of like when fishing line gets pulled through your hand too quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
which I can imagine, even though I've never experienced.
Yeah, it's it sucks. Yeah. but yeah, like these are not just regular spiders that have been blown up to, you know, movie size. They are bigger beasts that more closely resemble spiders. You know, again, there's an element of the indescribable here. But I do like that they have yellow racing stripes.
Yeah, they're party spiders. They've
so
got piping,
so they can go faster.
They're uncanny X spiders. So, and it takes out three of them. Like it's a big deal, heavy losses for this. Yeah. Like if this were a, this War of Mine expedition, it would be a failure.
Yeah. This is like Unius, our new run.
Yes. Ollie ends up shooting some of them, to save them. Of course, Mrs. Repler has the bug spray, in probably my least favorite thing about this story. now that I'm reading it, no, it's like, oh, they did do that twice, didn't they?
Well, she specifically was like gathering it up. Like she wanted more of it.
Yeah, I've got it. And she volunteers to go too.
Uh huh.
And just like, I'm just not here for like a old person acting young.
Uh huh.
For contrast's sake, like I'm just not here for it.
Right.
In general, so it's fine. Yeah. But you know, they get back, and this is so this the chapter, The Spell of Mrs. Carmody, the second night in the market, the final confrontation.
Yeah. And things have deteriorated very quickly in this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she has amassed more followers. You know, first it's two, then it's four, then it's eight, and then it is enough to be worth worrying about, right? Another quote here: when the machines fail, when the technologies fail, when the conventional religious systems fail, people have got to have something. Even a zombie lurching through the night can seem pretty cheerful compared to the existential horror and comedy of the ozone layer dissolving under the combined assault of a million fluorocarbon spray cans of deodorant.
Yeah.
This is something King does. Like, it's weird that this came out concurrently with The Stand, because that is also, like, one of the major morals of The Stand, is the idea of, you know, what people turn to when everything goes away. Right.
Yeah.
Specifically with this kind of environmental kind of bent to it.
Yeah. You know, and explicitly, like, you know, them going to this, somebody, we talk about this all the time on shows, like somebody promising like an easy religious answer that seems to work.
Yeah.
You know, it's worth, just as we're, you know, we're bringing up movie differences as we go in the movie, there's a little bit more kind of holiness lent to Mrs. Carmody, because an ill bug lands on her and doesn't bite her because she prays.
Yeah. Well, in the movie, she specifically says, like, you know, like, as she is praying, like, my life for you.
Yes.
Which it, I mean, dude, that is from The Stand, actually, like, and also from The Dark Tower. Thank you for reminding me of that, because I totally would have breezed past it. She is pledging to whatever is the master of these things. In The Stand, that might have been Randall Flagg, but he has always been the agent of the Crimson King, right? And so, you know, like, and that is, you know, the Crimson King has dominion over the Toad Ash spaces. So yeah, like, that is a good connection that I totally missed. She has put herself in the red by doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Pledged herself to Nyarlathotep. The tap.
Yep. Yep. Nyarlathotep, that ass. Man,
like on that auction show. Nyarlathotep. Yeah. Like the Storage Wars, but with just elder tomes and buckets.
This book has four eyes. Four eyes. Do we have four eyes? Cause five eyes.
Nyarlathotep. The so is degraded more than just that. Like, it's her with her followers, but also Amanda says, like, hey, four people have killed themselves.
Right. Oh, so
she's bringing
six?
Up sacrifice again. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Amanda says that, like, with a real knowing wink. Like, oh, it's actually, well, actually, ma'am.
Did you look under the dog food, Amanda?
Yeah. Geez, Amanda, you really fucked this one up. So it's like, fuck, man. Like, you know, this is getting real bad. The sacrifice. David says, like, hey, you know, I know that the plan didn't go super great at the pharmacy, but we can't stay here, man. Like,
no,
this is proving me right. What if they operate by scent? Or no, David doesn't say that. David starts thinking it, like, he's ready to get out. And he's like, he has this theory about them operating by scent.
Yeah. It's like, if we get to the car as soon as possible, we will be effectively invisible to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he kind of gathers like a small group that he can fit in his car. And Ollie puts some groceries by the door so they can make it out. At 4 a.m, they try to make it out, but Mrs. Carmody's waiting for them.
Yes.
Carmody's waiting.
Stops them. You know, she has destroyed the groceries. And she begins her cries for expiation. Her word of the day, expiation.
Yes.
I love that line. That's not in the book. It's in the movie. I love this line. Her pantsuit was a yellow scream in the gloom.
Yeah. Explicitly, she's saying, like, hey, we need the boy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not just you. We're going to say, you know, not just sacrifice in general.
No.
Is going to be sacrifice of your son.
Right. Either because he is so young, or because she just does not like that David is, you know, the kind of the last voice of reason present, you know, so effective at, you know, amassing these people possibly against her. And she pulls like a little, you know, you want the bull, you get the horns, and calls for Amanda's death as well.
Yeah.
You know, and like she is going like full on witch at this point.
Yep.
And Ollie, to protect the group, kills her. Like, he shoots her in the stomach and she folds over, and he, you know, freaks out about it.
Yeah. I wouldn't have done it if there was another way.
Right.
And it's just like, we know, you know, we got to get out of here.
That's why.
All the people are hanging out, they get out of there. Yeah. That's why I thanked you. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Sorry to cut you off there.
No, I cut you off. But yeah, they escape while the crowd is stunned. Like, they've left them without their savior, you know, to go into the distance, to, you know, to leave the womb, you know. And so once they're outside, they're exposed to the beast. In this final chapter, the end, you know, a huge scorpion gets Holly, you know, a spider gets Hattie Turman, and they make it to the car with five of them.
Yeah. They get there, they have their gun, they have four bullets left, they drive off.
Right.
And they drive south, and the fog just keeps coming.
Yeah, like, they get from Bridgeport all the way, or Bridgeton, all the way, like, down basically to the southern border of Maine. Nothing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, they can't get home. They try to check on his wife, but the roads are twisted. Like, they can't do it.
Right. So yeah, like they have no way of knowing if Stephanie is alive, but by all evidence, no. No, she's not. Yeah. His wife is gone, and you know, his son has slept through that, so you know, he doesn't have to get that. And this is where it's revealed that David has been writing this in his, you know, kind of this journal, this account at a Howard Johnson's at a Hojo's near the southern border of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And they look out, they're kind of seeing these like gigantic fantastic beasts.
I love both this section of the movie and of the book.
Yeah.
Where
I mean, we'll get to the movie end here in like a second, because yeah. it's very, very good.
Yeah, but specifically this movie, the seeing the different kinds of beasts that the mist brought, like these things that defy any notion of human scale.
Yeah. Yeah. It's real good. The Billy says like, oh, is that a dinosaur? You know, like they were like literally that big.
Right.
You know, and they're not like, you know, they can't smell them, so they're not attacking them. Like it's undeniably dangerous, but they're in this like little, it's like they're in a diving bell,
right,
surrounded by sharks. You know, it is like this weird, like they're in this little bubble of you know, insecure safety.
Mm-hmm.
Amidst just like unimaginable danger.
Right.
You know, really, really good.
Yeah. One in particular makes a blue whale look like a trout, they say, and yeah. It's just covered in those flesh flies.
Yeah. Yep, yep. They get to the end, and he really draws, like, there's some author insert stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
He draws in a line under, he's like, you know, I'm not going to give you a neat conclusion. That's something my dad would have called a Hitchcock ending.
Right.
Kind of bullshit. You know, however, you know, and he kind of says some things that they could do,
right.
You know, he mentions like having the four bullets and like, maybe, you know, it's like, we could take that route out,
right.
You know, and then I could find something else for myself to do, mm-hmm. You know? But eventually he says, that he has a little bit of hope.
Mm-hmm. Because when he was having sex with Amanda, on the radio in the office, he heard through the static one particular word, Hartford, as in, yeah, Hartford, Connecticut. So they just have to go south, and hopefully, maybe, possibly, there will be people there waiting for him. And yeah, that's what it ends on. Two words, Hartford, yeah, and hope.
Yeah, the ending is mildly more clumsy than that. He says like two words that sound the same, Hartford, yeah, like Hartford and hope, and like those don't sound at all right, the same. Like they have an H, but like, come on. you get your misdaddled brain back into the rhyme zone, buddy. but it's, you know, they're going to go. So it ends on, I would say, a positively ambiguous note.
Right. Right. They at least, you know, have a goal. Right.
Yes. And likely that they make it. Like, we don't know that they would make it,
mm-hmm,
but that's the easiest end to fill in from the book, I think.
Yeah.
Like they at least make it to Hartford.
They have a plan at the very least to like regas up the four wheeler, you know?
Yeah. Yep. That's the end. And the ending is good. Like the ending of the book, other than that, Hartford and Hope sound the same thing. Like, I like that as an ending.
Right.
You know, I'm down for that. I'm down for this like suggested apocalypse they're moving, yeah, through.
And Hollywood abhors an ambiguous ending with, mm-hmm, you know, and on the whole, there are a couple of exceptions to that. And so they had to bring a little bit more conclusion to it when they adapted this to the film. Usually that hurts things. I love, mm-hmm, the ending to the movie. It is such a gut punch.
Yeah. I think this is one of my favorite movie endings ever.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's real bleak, you know, but the way they do it, like, so it becomes, there's not like music really in the movie so much.
Right.
Until this point, there's a little bit, but they leave, they make it through, and it becomes this like very long, eerily peaceful shot of them going through this world that is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is covered in these spider webs, and this like music that's like choral music that's playing.
Yeah.
And like they go back and visit home, and he sees his wife like in a cocoon.
Right.
You know, and it's like the saddest fucking thing. You know, until eventually they just run out of gas. Which, like, in the book, they're like, you know, maybe I could run out, you know, I'd be outside the car, but I might be able to siphon some.
Right.
You know, and it's like, well, that's going to be a big dramatic thing we're not going to see.
Mm-hmm.
Like them not really considering that. Like, it's like, we can't leave the fucking car. Like, making it to the car killed like three people.
Right.
You know, we're not going to make it if we have to siphon gas. Like, we were able to go, but this is it. Mm-hmm. You know?
So. Yeah. And so, like, you get to this point, and for me, you know, my initial watch, and I kind of even forgot some of the details of this. I didn't know when the credits were going to kick in. And mm-hmm, that's the tension of this, because from the moment they run out of gas, any part of this could have been the last scene. It could have been the last shot, right? Like, oops, out of gas, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, you know, good.
That would have been like much more ambiguous.
Yes.
You know, like, you just run out of gas, and then it's like, well, we presume they starved to death. Oopsie-doo, you know. Instead, he like they look at him. He gives a look to it to his buddy, who like kind of nods. It's like, yeah, we're I've got enough bullets to shoot the three of you. I think it is in the movie, but there's four of us.
Right.
And he goes to shoot his kid. His kid wakes up. His kid's sleeping. Mm-hmm. Wakes up just for a second, and then that pans out to a long shot of the car.
Right.
And you get the three shots. He shot his other companions.
Right. And he is left by himself, and he's incredibly distraught, having just done this awful but necessary thing, you know, yeah. necessary in his mind. You know, he like, even knowing that the gun is empty, he opens it and dry fires into his mouth, you know, sobbing. Just it's pretty rough. And so
they're good screams. Like it is good. Like I like Thomas Jane.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. Like he's not in anything,
right?
You know, like he doesn't like get to act really anymore, but like, I like that Punisher movie. I like Thomas Jane in this. Like, right. I think he's a good actor.
Right.
And these like just anguish, just like, you know, pain, like it's really good.
Yeah.
I think.
And so he decides the quickest way to end it is to get out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is
suicide
he is,
by monster.
Right. He has spared everybody else the, you know, the horror of the particular death that he has consigned himself to. You know, this is a final selfless act that he has done, again, fulfilling this role that he has been in the entire time of, you know, the leader and facilitator. Yeah. And he's out there and he has no idea why things aren't taking him.
Yeah. He starts yelling, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. Come on.
He goes, until Lieutenant Dan.
Yeah. It's very Lieutenant Dan. Yeah. You know? You start seeing people walking out of the mist with flamethrowers.
Yeah.
And a truck pull out and a tank pull up and a truck that has that woman who left in the very beginning before the monster started pouring out.
Carol from The Walking Dead.
Yeah. You know, like he didn't have to do that.
No.
You
know, the mist clears up. Like, you know, with the mist gone, you can see like the carnage that has happened to the earth and to the woods and all these animals around him. But, you know, he is there sobbing next to this car that is, you know, has his dead son in it.
Yeah. He made the best choice he could with incomplete information. It's, you know, on some level it's like, yes, it's a little bit silly because like, you know, he could have just waited a second, but it's such an homage to like, well, yeah. I mean,
he decided to do it. It's a little bit silly because it happened so immediately after, but like,
yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead and finish your point.
Which is it's a coincidence, but the ending ends up being, it's so like, Twilight Zone Harlan Ellison-y.
Yes.
Like it feels like a Twilight Zone to me.
Mm-hmm.
In the best possible way. Like this is a very like ironic, you know, if you had just waited a little bit longer, you wouldn't have this.
Right.
You know, and it's an appropriate, like they died. He's not gonna be okay.
No. Yeah, like, he's done. His life is over.
Yeah, this you don't come back from that.
Right.
You know, and it is the ultimate, to me, the reason why it works, as much as it is kind of over the top, is that like it is the ultimate expression of the thesis of the movie and book, which is like, what do you do? You know, what are different ways people react to being confronted by this?
Mm-hmm.
And this is like a really extreme one.
Yes.
You know, one of your instincts in this kind of situation is to protect the people you care about from it.
Mm-hmm. And protecting them can mean cutting it short before something more awful could happen to them.
Yeah. Protecting them from being devoured or being, because it's incredibly painful. There's a scene in the movie where his buddy Norton is in the drugstore and is like a nest and falls over and a million spiders fall out of his back.
Right.
It's horrific, you know? So like he's protecting them from something worse than death.
Right.
You know, it is a noble action, but it's an extreme action and he's pushed to that kind of extreme. That's one of the things that you can do in this situation.
Yeah.
And it just like, you know, it just pops onto that tragedy as like a thing to explore. Like it is even worse. Like the cost he paid is even worse than you'd expect.
It is like the balancing on this knife edge between, is it worth hoping or is it worth being realistic about what your options are and take, you know, and taking what has to be, what has to be the most merciful course of action.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a gut punch and a half.
It is. Like, you know, and you look at that, I can't say that I would have made a different decision at that at that moment, right? You know, because every time is like every minute that they're there in that car is, you know, just a tightening of the noose. It is panic, it is people running out, it is ensuring that they are going to die in the suboptimal way.
Yeah.
I say that as though I would have made it that far. I would have been one of those people who left in the opening.
Oh, who knows? Like, I would probably be like one of the sleeping pills people. Like, it's, yeah. You know, it's if I had to be one of the people, like the painless death would have been probably my choice. But yeah, it's incredibly intense. He, Frank Darabont, wanted to do this ending. He came up with it. Stephen King loved it.
Yep.
Like Stephen King, it has his blessing. He's like, oh, that's way better than what I came up with.
Yep.
And then he had this, he was going to do this movie with a production company. They wanted to change the ending. He said no deal and did it for like less budget.
Yep.
In exchange for getting to do it like the way he wanted to, because he realized like it's very important to this.
Yeah.
So well,
like, so this is ultimately, you know, weirdly, it's weird to call that hopeful. It's hopeful for the world because there is still order in the book. You know, who knows how far this mist is gone? Who knows if they're even in the same dimension, in the same world, in the same level of the tower, or if they are firmly entrenched in Todash space? Like, you know, at the very least in the movie, even though our main character, you know, no longer has a life, his wife and child are dead, he has done, you know, something terrible, even though it felt necessary. The world can go on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's both endings are good.
Yeah.
The idea of like the implied adventures of these, this group of survivors going to Hartford and dealing with this new status quo is cool.
Yeah.
This situation where this person is actually pushed to this limit is also cool.
Yeah.
They're both good. I was surprised by how, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the episode, but it's like so accurate. Like other than that, really that ending and a couple of little things that we pointed out, like a lot of the dialogue in the movie comes directly from the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is because it's a novella, it adapts to a book really well. Adapts to a movie very well. Like I imagine that's a thing, as somebody, you know, if you've read a lot of the books like you have and watched a lot of the adaptations, like that ends up being a problem. Like things being too condensed.
Right.
You know, and this is, since it's a shorter work, that doesn't really happen here.
Yeah. I need to make some time to at least watch a couple of episodes of the TV show just to see if there's anything worth noticing there. Like 2 hours feels appropriate for this.
You know?
Just like if they tried to stretch this story out beyond the, you know, the novella limit, I think it would have overstayed its welcome. Right. I don't think there is enough here. I think that the story as it exists is incredibly strong. And does, you know, map to film very well. I think that this is a very strong choice, you know, for them to have adapted to a film.
I think so too.
Yeah.
And as somebody who like didn't come at this from a perspective of Stephen King affection, this is easily and like this is in the top three like Lovecraft movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not explicitly a Lovecraft movie, but it may as well be.
Right.
And it's like it is as good to that tone as The Thing or Mouth of Madness.
Right.
I think.
Yeah.
Like, so it's got things for everybody.
Yeah.
You know,
some very good ideas, some just wonderful, wonderful horror.
Yeah, absolutely. Good shit. I'm glad that you did this and I got an opportunity to talk about with you.
Yeah. I'm really happy you came on. It is a story I really enjoy and by gosh, man, I love doing podcasts with you. So it's good having you on.
Yeah, I'm making the rounds. I'm doing my punch cards of Duck Feed shows. So at some point I'm going to come on Those Damn Ross Kids, but I'm going to do it just as Chris and as opposed to being as you. Like, hey, you little weenie. Is that good? Is that how he does it?
Yep, that's exactly, it's him. Spitting image. I can't tell the difference.
Hey, you dork. I'm Chris. Like, I have a daughter. That's, there we go.
All the
indistinguishable
points.
Indistinguishable.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Garybuh, GARYBUH, and then on the Duckfeed TV network on all the other shows except for Those Damn Ross Kids and The Level.
Right. So next time we're going to be talking about the It movie, because It as a story is tower connected. I don't know, I have much better, much higher hopes for that movie as a movie than the Dark Tower one.
You're talking about the new It movie?
Yes.
Yeah. You have to tell me how that is. I like the old It movie.
Yep.
I want to see if it's, I wonder if the how the new one is.
Oh, I'll tell you, it's the trailers look very good.
Yeah, I've been watching the trailers. It does look good. I gotta get that to Curry, you know, like Curry.
It's
I can't imagine them improving on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, out of every other part could be improved upon,
right?
But that won't be.
You're John's Ritter.
Rest
in peace.
Yeah, you can always up a John's Ritter.
Cool. Well, we're doing that next time, and then we're doing The Stand as a two-parter after that. And after that, we're going to begin Wizard and Glass. I'm very excited. That is a very good book.
The third one or fourth one?
Fourth one, yes. Yeah. So if you want to help the show out, you can share it with your friends, especially because we are in this off-season where we're talking about smaller things. If you know people who like Stephen King movie adaptations, send this episode their way. I thought it was fun. I hope you thought it was fun. But otherwise, ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to go over to patreon.com/duckfeedtv, you can check that out. One of the tiers that we have, one of our milestone goals, is actually to do something very similar to this. Gary and I want to talk about Lovecraft-related movies. So yes. This could be considered kind of a backdoor pilot for that.
Oh, absolutely. Like, originally I was like, oh, let's not talk about the movie because I want to save it for that show, but this is the book so much like the movie. Like, it's this hard. Is the backdoor pilot for that.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's lots of other Lovecraft adaptations and Lovecraftian adaptations, and we both love that shit.
Yep.
It would be really fun to talk about that. The working title of that is Unfilmable. Mm-hmm. I need to see if there is another podcast called that.
Yeah.
And if not, I think that's a good name for something like this.
Yep.
And it would also, that would be a fun show too, because not everything will be this good.
No.
there's a lot of trash in that. Yeah. Bucket.
This is the high water mark, like, outside of The Thing.
100%. Yeah. And Mouth of Madness, which I love.
Yeah.
And Reanimator, which is really campy fun. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of low cards in that deck.
Yeah.
But that'd be really fun to do, because there's good short films and shit. There's like compilation DVDs that are very good.
Yeah.
From the film festival. That'd be a really fun show to do.
Very much so.
So
So help us get there. $1 or $2 at a time. That is really all it takes, and it makes a gigantic difference for us as people who podcast full time. You know,
absolutely.
Like, that is a big deal for us. So, until next time, long days and pleasant nights. And Gary, I want you to say, and may you have twice the number.
And may you have twice the number.
Thank you.